welcome to this next episode of Unfinished Business with me, Andy Clark, and with him,
Richard Rutter.
How you doing, Rich?
I'm doing very well, thanks, Andy. Nice to join you again.
So, when we started doing this podcast again, we wanted a slightly different format. We didn't want to just talk to each other all the time, pleasanter that is. We wanted to bring people in who were working in different areas of what might be called creative services. And I'm incredibly pleased to have John Harvey joining us today. John, nice
Hello.
To meet you.
It's a pleasure to be with you guys. Thanks for having me on.
So for people who don't know the name of John Harvey, tell us a little bit about what you do.
So my full name is Jonathan Harvey, and there are lots of Jonathan Harveys in the media where I work. And I seem to be cursed that wherever I go, there's another arguably more successful Jonathan Harvey. Worked in BBC News, and there's, I think, the guy who edits the PM programme or World at One is a Jonathan Harvey. I did a lot of music when I was younger, and there was a quite well-known composer called Jonathan Harvey. And these days I work in comedy, and there's a quite successful writer who wrote things like Gimme, Gimme, Gimme and Beautiful Thing, Beautiful People. And he's called Jonathan Harvey, which is very frustrating. But I'd like to think I'm in the top four, or maybe the Europa League places of Jonathan Harveys in the cultural sphere of this country. So, yeah, so I'm officially John Harvey, and I'm a mixture of a writer, an author, a radio presenter, a producer. And I have a peculiar sideline as a politician, because I'm the sort of human alter ego of a certain intergalactic space warrior called Count Binface. And if that's not a portfolio career, I don't know what is.
That's how we got to know each other, was through the Count, our mutual friend. But maybe we'll talk a little bit about the Count later on. How did you get into this? Tell us a little bit about your background.
Into comedy, do you mean?
Into comedy writing. I'd most been exposed to your work through Have I Got News For You?
Oh, yeah. Well, so yeah. I produced and written on that. I make the end of year show every year. I've been doing that since 2010. It's a great job. It's like I call it like the now that's what I call satire mega mix of a sort of a year's Have I Got News For You. And it's just me watching the show and picking my favourite bits. It's a dream job. I love doing that. Yeah. Basically, I was always a huge comedy fan when I was a kid. My dad and my brother indoctrinated me with all the greats: Porridge, Blackadder, Fawlty Towers, Only Fools and Horses, all the usual British BBC comedies. And then as I got older, Red Dwarf, Father Ted, all that kind of stuff. I just was steeped in it and adored it. And it was always what I wanted to do. And then when I went to university, I met some friends who were like-minded. And instead of joining one of those sort of troops that you get, the Footlights or the Oxford Review, we just got hold of a camcorder and started making our own sketches and even stop motion animations and stuff and just doing it for a laugh. And then after university, I joined the BBC, did a range of jobs there, random stuff from arts to the unit that opens the post, which was a bit frightening, to Greg Dyke, the then Director General's office during the Hutton inquiry. It was mad times. But eventually I wiggled and wangled my way into BBC News, and then got plucked out of there by a producer I'm sure you've heard of called Armando Iannucci. And I started working on a show called Time Trumpet. And that was mainly out of things like showing Armando the sketches that we'd be making on our camcorder, which in those days there was no YouTube. So we had to actually make our own DVD, which we sent Armando. And that got me my first meeting. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Amazing. I mean, it's a strange thing, and I think even Rich, in our industry, there are sometimes those breaks that you get. There are those people that you meet or those connections that you make that just take you off in a different direction.
Yeah, that's right. And John, in our line, so mine and Andy's line of work is designing websites. And within that career or that industry, there's lots of freelancers. So there's lots of people who are going from one gig to the next, designing websites or applying their certain bits of expertise. I run a small agency called Clear Left. We use freelancers every now and then. I've been a freelancer in the past. And I was just said that everyone's self, all of the freelancers, they're self-employed. I was wondering if that kind of rings true at all for you as well, whether you talked about portfolio career, lots of strings to your bow. So how do you see yourself from a business perspective? Because I guess you don't have a full-time job to rely on.
Yeah, don't rub it in.
Think about things from a slightly different way.
Yes, my career's gone into, I'd say, three major blocks. I was at the BBC for 8 years. And bizarrely, in all that time, the longest contract I was ever given was 12 months, which is technically illegal. After 2 years, they were supposed to make me staff, and they went back on that. I've got all the emails to prove it. And they said this Damocles hanging over my head, but I loved it and was desperate to work there. And so I think they do this with a lot of people. They take advantage of people's goodwill. And I love the BBC. I love what it stands for, but there's always been two types of BBC. There's all the people who work for it, which are amazing. And there's a kind of officer class, which kind of looks after its own. And there are pros and cons to that. Then for 9 years, I was an employee at Hattrick Productions, and that's run by Jimmy Mulville. And you mentioned about getting breaks. I think this is particularly true in the arts. I think it really helps if you have a patron, someone hopefully influential and who's got clout, who chooses to back you. And so the first person who did that in my career was Armando. And then the second was Jimmy Mulville at Hattrick. And so he became a big backer of me. And at Hattrick for 9 years, I worked on a lot of shows, including Have I Got News For You, but also got a lot of shows away myself, particularly on radio, and became a producer and a writer and really earned my spurs. I won a couple of audio awards at the BBC for that. And then the most recent phase of my career since 2019 is I've been a freelancer. Which is doing all these different spinning plates and everything. I've just started using Trello, and you should see my Trello. It's mad trying to keep tabs on all the things I'm doing. I sort of go, oh my God, yeah, I'd love to just be one thing in a way, but I keep doing all these different things, which is both a blessing and a curse. And yeah, I suppose from a business side of thing, that's how I earn. I sometimes I'm writing for newspapers, or I'm presenting for the radio. Next minute I'm producing a Radio 4 panel show, or I'm making a show that I've had self-commissioned. I jump from lily pad to lily pad, and there's very little security in it. I know next year, supposedly, I've got maybe $20,000 coming to me, but with the cost of living, that's not very much. And the best metaphor I can give you is, if you remember that Wallace and Gromit film, The Wrong Trousers, where Gromit is there's this sort of train chase. He's sort of chasing the penguin. And he's got the track, and he's laying out the train track as he's chasing. And that's my career. I'm sure a lot of people would feel some sort of similarity with that. And then you're just hoping you're not going to smack into the kitchen wall and it all stops.
That thing's about our industry is that constant hunger and not knowing where you are. I remember we had a business consultant that came to visit us from the local council once back in the day when business consultants worked for the local council. And he was like, where are you going to see yourself in 5 years? And I'm like, where am I going to see myself in 5 months or 5 weeks?
5 minutes, mate.
It's that. Or in 5 minutes. It's that kind of constant hamster wheeling, which, I've got to say, is not the easiest thing to do in the world.
Yeah, I mean, that laying the tracks down in front of you as you're moving along, that sounds so familiar. I mean, at Clear Left, I have 16 mouths to feed, and that doesn't include my own family. And at any given time, you can only really be confident about 3 months ahead. After that, it's oblivion, and that goes on all the time. So you've got this permanent kind of level of, where am I going to lay this next track? So I feel that.
And it's strange, isn't it? Because there's a double, there's a freelancer, you're constantly told, oh, you have to put aside X amount for tax and everything. But I find, I don't know, I'm still having to pay off last year's tax, let alone this year. You're chasing your tail, aren't you? It's very difficult to get ahead. And I suppose this isn't going to read well on podcasts, but I'll have to try and describe it. I always paint a picture. There's two ways that a freelancer's career can go in the arts, which is either you're hoping that it's flatlining and then suddenly there'll be the jump upwards. I suppose it's the Nike tick is what we talk about, isn't it? That your career, there's all that speculation talking about, and then eventually it pays off and off you rocket. Or what happens is it does just flatline. And then at some point you've got to think, maybe this isn't for me. And I'm in a very double-edged situation right now. I'm speaking to you. This is now June 2025. And I think I'm on course for my best year yet as a freelancer. And yet I'm kind of wondering where that next bit of money's coming, because it's getting swallowed up faster and faster. It's cost of living, it's all kinds of things. And it's so I think lots of people feel like they're in their same boat, where it's like, hang on a minute, it's not as if I'm not getting anywhere through being creative, but it's just, are you getting further enough, deep enough, quickly enough.
Yeah, and I've just seen that your documentary on the Sharkiverse has just gone out onto BBC Sound. So that sounds like that must have been fun putting that together. But I'm guessing that's something you probably did a while ago and your focus is very much on what's coming up next. But what was it about, I don't know, the history of fiction featuring sharks that got you into that?
I suppose two things there. Firstly, in terms of the making it, so we're talking in June, it went out, I think, a week and a half ago, almost 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I finished making it about 2 weeks before then. So I end up working up to very tight deadline just because of the nature of what I had three big deadlines on at the same time. Those close to me say it's because I can't manage my time properly. And I disagree with that. No, it's just because I've got lots on and things all just piled on at once. But yeah, that's a great example of where, you know, I wrote, produced and presented that program. You could call me a bit of an auteur, but it's only in the radio at the moment. I love Radio 4. It's a wonderful place to do things. It's one of the most inventive places to be creative in the UK. But it was so many people for such a small piece of the pie. And at the moment, the way I get on the radio often is by me, sort of me asking or pitching myself, rather than what you're hoping is eventually people go, oh, that guy's good. We should get him to present or produce. And then eventually you're hoping for that critical moment where people come to you. So at the moment, I have to self-generate an awful lot. That's where the tiredness comes from, because you're having to work on the thing you're concentrate on what you're working, but also that next bit of the sausage factory, you know, what's the next thing down the line? How do you keep it going? So that's a very difficult thing. As for why I got into sharks, two things. Firstly, obviously, Jaws is an incredible film and I love it as much or more than most people. But also as part of the making silly comedies that I've been doing with my friends for 25 years now, one of the first, I adore watching and collecting the worst films ever made. And shark movies are a very rich vein for that. The one that smashed the door down for us was Shark Attack 3 Megalodon, which I put a clip of that on YouTube in 2007, I think it was. YouTube was very embryonic and it's had 60 million hits on my channel. At one point, it was one of the 100 most watched videos in the world. And I've made Edinburgh shows about it. I've done all sorts. So it was crying out to be folded into a sort of a shark exploitation program. So it was a kind of dream come true, 25 years in the making, to finally get that on air. And credit to my best friend, Tom Walker, who's an even bigger walking shark encyclopedia. And on which note, there is a film called Super Shark, which features a walking shark. And he and I have been itching to make this program for a long time. So it was a dream come true to do it.
So just going back a little minute to something that you said a moment ago about actually asking to do the work rather than just putting stuff out there into the universe and hoping that somebody comes across it and says, hey, I've got a project, I think I'll get him to work on this with me, which is certainly over the last few years been my approach. It's like, I'm going to put stuff out there and hopefully people will find it interesting. And then the next time they feel like they need a piece of design work doing, they'll remember somehow, hey, I watched this YouTube video or I read this article about how you could do Yogi Bear animations in CSS. I'll use that guy. Actually, I should be more proactive. I should be knocking on the door of Cartoon Network or Hanna-Barbera or whoever it is and going, hey, listen, your website looks like every other fucker. Why don't we do something cool? And I'm the guy to help you.
I think you need to do both those things. So a lot of my stuff is self-generated. All the virals that I've made that have had millions of hits, I've been very successful. But no one knows it's me because a lot of my stuff is mashup editing and everything, and as well as Binface, which also no one knows it's me because I'm wearing a bin on my head, which is not ideal for recognition. Again, double-edged sword. It's quite handy for the anonymity, but no one's thinking, oh, we'll get him because no one knows who it is. You can find out, like you guys have, but most people either don't want or don't care to know who does it. They just want to know that someone is doing it. Or maybe they don't care. Who knows? But so I think in this day and age, you can't rely on just the old school method, which is knocking on doors and hoping. I think people do want and expect to see that you're doing stuff anyway. You could write to a comedy writing company and say, hey, I'm a writer. And they'll go, what have you done? And it's not just a question of having a bundle of pages. If you've done stuff online, it's proof of what you've been doing. Like you guys with your podcast, if you've done a couple of hundred episodes, it says this is actually a real thing. It's not just a couple of blokes shouting into a hole because we fancy wasting our time and we like the sound of our own voice. It's a genuine thing. You've put the effort in. So you've got to do both. And the conundrum I have at my point in my career is where I get some level of notice, hence you guys talking to me. It's not enough yet that it's reached that, like I say, that sort of that magic Rolling Stone moment where then people are booking you or pushing you forward. So it's still a lot of it is coming from me. So I have to work out to what extent do I need to do more self-generation. I've got an idea for a new YouTube channel, which is a vaguely educational thing I want to do with your videos and socials. But again, to do anything properly like that, you have to pour a lot of resource and time into it. So how do you find the time to do that? As well as writing a novel, which my agent wants me to do, or pitching to America, which I want to be doing. Or there are so many things pulling and vying for your attention. You only have so many hours in the day. So you have to be quite strategic about it and be your own sort of general. There's no perfect way to do it, is there? It's you just have to follow your instincts a little bit.
Yeah, and it's difficult. It's the same for us running an agency as well, with not that many people of us. And ideally, they're all busy doing paid work, which leaves no time for the rest of us to market ourselves, go out and tell the world what we are doing, what we have done, what we can do. And that's the way you drum up new business. And it's always that conflict and, just not enough time to do these things.
I was just saying, I suppose part of it is there is a lot of luck involved in this, but you've got to decide in the freelance world amount of time you want to spend on your own development, which might be which could turn out to be the big thing, the big ticket. Or do you focus on that sort of more hand-to-mouth thing, but the stuff that gets the bills paid? So I'll give you an example. Like I'm waiting literally today, as we're recording this, for an email to come through, which could be a couple of months, maybe more work on something quite cool, which might pay relatively well and would keep the wolf from the door potentially for the rest of the year and would be like, oh, a great thing to say I'm working on. But it would eat a large proportion of my time up, which might slow down me doing the stuff like writing the book, which I've started, which doesn't necessarily make you any money whatsoever. But if it's any good and it can sell and it could be, oh, debut novel by Count Binface bloke, whatever, it turns out to be really good, could be career changing. You look at people like Richard Osman, who'd been far more far more successful than me in every sphere of his life, but he took the time to write his book, and that has been a game changer for him. So the good thing is I've written two books in my time, and both the manuscripts I've written and attempted to sell have sold. So that makes me think, if and when I can get another bundle of pages together, I've got at least a decent chance of it doing okay in the market. But you have to invest that much time in the front end before people will even look at it. So there's no right or wrong answer to this, but with each person particularly in the creative industry, that push and pull is that's the magic trick. If you can get that, you can get great success. The issue is, of course, that you need just that bit of capital to be able to keep you going, to get that creative stuff out of your system so that you can then sell it. And I don't know about anyone listening or you guys, but that's the crux of me, is always having enough bandwidth, financial bandwidth, just to support you to get that thing out there, which could be the thing that sends you off to be the next Armando Iannucci.
We've both written books and been far less successful than yours, I think, because we've been writing for it's safe to say it's a niche audience, which, isn't it? Web typography.
Yeah, that's pretty niche.
I never thought I'd hear that.
So definitely more niche than A Fan for All Seasons, which...
Oh, thank you.
So have you sold the film rights to Web Typography, Rich?
No, I haven't, although I am doing a second edition.
Oh, so. Breaking news.
But if you include the ebook, there's nearly 20,000 people have bought it, which is not nobody. But at the same time, it's not exactly Richard Osman territory.
No, but that's amazing. Publishing is a much bigger deal than it was. I think there was a time when self-publishing was a euphemism for vanity publishing or vice versa. And it was very much looked at sniffily. I think the internet has changed that. I think 50 Shades of Grey was originally, not that I've read it, was originally an ebook. And look where that went. You to mention my book, yeah, A Fan for All Seasons is the memoir I wrote about and my brother and sport and grief when he died. It's funny, I was reading an article today, I think it was in the New Yorker, where someone who has, I think, written something about a deceased relative described all that kind of material as the grief industrial complex, which is a kind of harsh way of talking about the fact that lots of people do write books about that kind of thing. But it was a real labor of love for me that maybe I would have sold more self-publishing that than you do actually in the market, because the competition is so fierce. And not that this is particularly a publishing podcast, but from my understanding, and I've had eminent authors turn around to me and say, it's actually, they use the word racket. I can't tell you that's true or not, but they've said that based on the fact that really, aside from the independent bookshops, there is only one person in the country deciding whether your book is visible. And that is the buyer at Waterstones. Because Waterstones now owns Daunt Books. Obviously, Waterstones is the main sort of slightly, what do you say, not highbrow, but the decent bookshop in most towns and cities across the UK. I think they also, do they own Foils? I'm not sure. But anyway, basically,
yeah,
that person will be the gatekeeper to whether your book gets on the tables in Waterstones. Is one thing, my book was in Waterstones, but sometimes it was in the sports bit with its spine out. So who's going to see that unless you're actively looking for sports books really closely? Whereas other books, they'll be 20 deep on the tables, which is effectively the bookshop saying, come buy this book. So for anyone out there thinking, oh, I know if I can get a published book, I'll have made it. It's not as simple as that, because you need to have a published book that is one of the very small minority of published books that they really back. So it's sometimes being free of that and self-publishing and finding 20,000 people to buy your book on Web Typography. I would say that's a huge achievement.
And the motivation I had for self-publishing was that it was a book I wanted to write, and I knew I just wanted to do it right, and that it was going to take a long time to do, a lot of my time to do. And so I thought, I just want control over everything. I just want to cover my costs. I don't really care if not that many people buy it. I just want it to exist. And that was the motivation. But I did it all through Kickstarter, because I knew I wanted to have it professionally edited and so on, and that was going to cost me money. And then do your own print run, and that costs thousands and thousands of pounds to get books made before you've sold them. But at least Kickstarter sort of enables you to have a pre-made audience to a certain degree. And then the ebook is really where all the sales have been. But yeah, that was the motivation, and yeah, it was lovely that people have bought it.
So I've got to mention him, John. I've got to talk about the fella that actually brought us together in the first place, which of course is intergalactic space warrior Karen Binface. I think it would be remiss of me to not ask, where the hell did that come from?
It's a very long story. Firstly, I should say, actually, give the lie to what you said earlier. The reason we met is because you wrote an article, didn't you, on your website saying, here's Count Binface's website and here are all the things that are wrong with it. And
That is true. Yes,
yeah,
I did.
I was a bit like, oh, this is harsh. It's just me. What do you expect? I'm not some professional web developer. I thought it did the job. Although you came in and made it much nicer, which I'm very grateful. But in a nutshell, it goes back to me watching films that are so bad they're funny. One of them was a ridiculously bad Star Wars parody in 1984. The first time anyone really attempted it, 3 years before Spaceballs. The baddie in the film is like a Darth Vader joke figure with a bucket on his head. The name Lord Buckethead is associated with it. Interestingly, in the film, he's not called that. He's just called the leader. In the credits, it says Lord Buckethead, and there's even a row in America about who came up with that name, whether it was the director of the film or the actress, who knows. Anyway, madly, we watched the film, it's a bag of shite, but at the end, if you read the online trivia like my friend and I did, it said, did you know someone stood in the general election in 1987 against Margaret Thatcher dressed as Lord Buckethead? And in 1992 against John Major in Finchley. As you go online, there he is. Incredible. But that's it. The bloke just stood there. And it was the bloke who'd bought the video rights to this film, just trying to flog the VHS of it. That's it. Didn't talk, nothing. Then it disappeared for 25 years, and my mate and I thought, oh, let's bring it back. That'd be funny. Just thought it'd be a laugh. It went viral, went mad around the world. I took on Theresa May, did music videos, ended up on Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, did Glastonbury. It was crazy. Then the American director of that film ended up trying to sue me for 9 months because he wanted to basically take advantage of what I'd done. And now my son has just arrived to join me. Hello. While I'm talking about it, do you want to say hello, Rowan?
Hello, Rowan.
I've got an invasion, an alien invasion. But yeah, anyway, because of that, I upgraded myself to Count Binface, and the rest is history.
Well, I'd love to talk to you again for longer at some point in the future, because there's so much that we could unpack. But I know you've got to go. I know your boss is now in the room.
The boss, the three-year-old boss, is here. What have we got to do now, Rowan? Have lunch. And who is Count Binface? That's right. I'm bringing up the next generation of Recyclons. That's his podcast debut. I'm so excited. There you go. Little baby Recyclon. And I'd love to talk more.
Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you soon. Thanks, John.
Honestly, it's a real pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on, Guy.
That was quite a cute ending, wasn't it?
Lovely.
Yeah. It keeps it real. There's a guy working at home, and his three-year-old wants lunch.
Yep.
So what did you make?
My dog was barking at the door as a delivery arrived or something.
So what did you make of that?
Oh, it was fascinating. Yeah. I'm glad John was open about the precariousness of a job, his chosen career path. Yeah, he's kind of waiting for the big break to actually make it all a bit easier in theory, although I'm sure even those who have the big breaks still suffered the same kind of anxiety. I don't know if anxiety is quite the right word, but lovely to hear it from his point of view. Interesting.
There was a resonated or just stuck out for me. This whole having a patron, I don't think he said the word patron, but having that would have confidence in you and back you, and that would be a stepping stone onto your next career, just reminded me of all the guys that come through Clear Left.
Yeah, so he was obviously talking about, Armando Iannucci and also Jimmy Mulville as, I guess, producers or showrunners or so on. And with people coming through Clear Left, whether it's interns or people like Kenneth, for example, who we hired, Kenneth Bowles as a UX designer. We knew Kenneth joined us and had ambitions beyond Clear Left, but he was great at what we did. So we're very happy to have him and help build up his personal profile in whatever way we could and send him on his way. And now he's carved out an academic career for himself and a career as a speaker around design ethics and so on. And that's just one person. I've seen others come through Clear Left who we've given a little bit of a leg up and certainly have supported afterwards. And that's just a joy to see. When you've been around 20 years as a company and as I have as a company founder, to see that and to see people who were here as interns, best part of 20 years ago, forging the careers that they are now, is just very pleasing. Not necessarily to take credit at all for that. It's down to them, but it's certainly nice to see.
It was funny. I suppose it's the frustrated artist in me, but I would just love a patron that would pay me to do what I want to do. I think the ultimate goal, isn't it? And it's not unheard of. I frequently talk about a designer called Giovanni Pintori, who was an Italian graphic designer who spent most of his career at Olivetti Business Systems back in the day when typewriters were the thing, and Olivetti typewriters. And he spent pretty much his entire career designing for Olivetti, and he created ads and booklets and brochures and catalogues and all this kind of stuff. But my God, he was just exercising his own personal design passion and exploration and all this kind of stuff. And I think that's the ultimate game is, hey, I want somebody to pay me on a regular basis so that I don't have to feel hungry all the time. But they'll pretty much let me explore my artistic interest.
Would your artistic, if that was the case, would your artistic interest lie in still creating websites for things? Is it a bit more esoteric than that if money wasn't a thing you had to concern yourself with?
That is a really good question. I would like to say or think that I would do something that was purely artistic. I would do printmaking, for example. But it's been so long doing web or digital stuff that I think I would still do web or digital stuff. It's one of those things that I would love to do more kind of artsy work. You get yourself channeled into a frame of mind, which is not doing the work because you either want to do it or you're trying to get an idea out, but you're second guessing yourself all the time. What purpose is this? Who's going to look at it? Why am I doing this? What's the reason? And the reason should be because I want to do it and I want to get this idea out. But when you've been working in creative services for as long as we have, it's much easier to start second guessing yourself.
Yeah. And I suppose that also thinking from like a patron's point of view, there'd be different kinds of patrons, wouldn't there? There'd be the ones who say, just here you go, I'll pay for you to live. You just do your thing because I believe in you and so on. And then others who'd be, I want you to be working in this area and doing this kind of stuff. Not that stuff over there. I don't like that. I like this stuff that you do. That's why I'm your patron. So you need to do those sorts of things. And
I have to say that the guys at Nozomi in and Nozomi Networks in Switzerland, there was an element of that where, you know, I was working on their product and was what they make their money on and everything else. But then I would come up with ideas for the interior design of the building, or I'd come up with ideas for a series of posters for the hallway, or even down to the actual kind of lanyard badges. Everybody got these, whatever they are, RF or magnetic entry badges, and they're all plain plastic badges. And I made stickers, a whole range of stickers that people could put on their badge. And they would go, yeah, that's a cool idea. Or, no, we don't like that. That's just crazy, and put that away. So there was a sort of an element of that which I really enjoyed. So I think it's about finding a balance.
I've got a few of the entry cards that from when we worked at the BBC quite a few years ago. And all the ones I've got are Doctor Who branded BBC sort of security cards, which are one of the few things from working at the BBC that I'm holding on to. Yeah, they were nice.
This idea of both putting good stuff out there, but also not being afraid to knock on doors. And in fact, he did remind me that that was exactly what I did when I first started working with him, was I was doing a series of articles on YouTube videos on political party websites. And in the hope of a Labour government, I started looking at Labour's website and it was dreadful. So I redesigned it on the spec and said, hey, and if anybody in Keir Starmer or Angela Rayner's office is reading this, then hey, get in touch. And they never did. And then I thought, I'll do some others. I'll do the Green Party. So I did that. And I said, if anyone in Carla Denyer's office is reading this, then get in touch. And they never did. And then I thought, I need a balance and I was not going to do reform. So I thought, which third party should I do? And then I thought, I know, I'll do Count Binface. So I did a kind of a redesign explanation about what the goals were and how I would bring this character to life online. And I did say, and if Count Binface is reading this, then get in touch. And actually, he did.
Which is pretty cool. Yeah, good on him for recognising an opportunity there.
Exactly, because being completely transparent, I didn't charge John for doing that job. I did it because I knew that Binface was going to get PR, it would be a good portfolio piece, it would be something that was very different from the other stuff that was in my portfolio at the time, which was a lot more kind of product work. And I wanted to have something in there which was completely out there. And then if you now look at that kind of progression of stuff that's in my portfolio all the way up to animated orangutans with Mike Wirth, it seems to have taken me down that path, which, so I didn't make any money out of John to start with, but I think that it's helped me gain work in other areas.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it must have been fun as well. You can really let yourself go with that one, I would imagine.
Yeah.
And especially as you didn't have an actual client until after you'd done it.
No. And I enjoyed coming up with other stuff as well. And I think that sometimes it's just nice to have space within a project. No pun intended. Intergalactic space warrior and everything. But it's nice to have time within a project where you can just go, yeah, so I wonder what the route from planet Sigma 9 to Earth is and what you'd have to go past. And I was like coming up with all these kind of star maps and graphics and things about maybe what was... And I made all of these kind of weird planet-shaped things that were that Binface would have on his journey to Earth, from the Death Star to donuts and all these kind of round-shaped things. And maybe some of that stuff makes it into the world, and maybe it doesn't. But I think it's having time to be able to explore that stuff that can make something better.
That's countbinface.com if anyone wanted to go and check it out for themselves.
I'll put some links in the show notes. I haven't looked at it for quite a while, actually, so I don't know what he's done with it in the meantime. But
it still looks like a fine piece of work, so he definitely hasn't ruined it, unlike happens sometimes.
So, yeah, I thought that was a really interesting conversation. The way that we're going to do this, audience, is that every 3 weeks, I think, we're going to have, or every 3 episodes, we're going to have a guest on, like John, to talk about stuff. And sometimes they'll be from inside the web industry or related businesses, or sometimes they'll be completely outside in other aspects of creative services. And I think that should give us lots of interesting conversations.
Yeah, should keep it interesting.
Thanks, Rich. I enjoyed that today.
Me too. Yeah, thanks for getting John on. I thoroughly enjoyed talking to him.
And I'll see you next time.
Will do. Bye.